Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Expressing your love can look many different ways. And with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Lisko.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James. I'm sitting in for your regular host, Constance Sampson, who lost the Academy Award for Best Actress for her work in Hot and Cold to Rachel Maron from the film Queen of the Night. Hot and Cold, of course, went on to win 6 Oscars, but Best Actress was not one of them. It did win Best Sound, though. We got to see that.
Emily, we have to do a podcast about the fictional Academy Awards from the film The Bodyguard from 1992.
I'm going to make no friends this episode. I'm coming in slinging heat. This movie fucking sucks. It stinks. It's bad. It's terrible. But the thing I liked, the thing I liked was the fake Oscars. That was great. Every moment of it.
I had a feeling you were going to like the fake Oscars, Emily. It felt like something that was very much in your
wife watched this with me. And she was like, I remember liking this movie. I think probably the soundtrack's better than the movie. And I was like, that seems like a safe assumption, but let's check it. It was a big, people loved it. It was a big movie. And she was watching it, like her face just fell. And she was like, nothing in this movie makes sense. Why did I like this when I was 10? It's because you were an idiot when you were 10. That's why.
So before we get into all of that, with us today.
Anyway, she also liked the fake Oscars. That was the point of that story.
Yeah. With us today is Andrew Ambrose Lee, Harper Thompson, Stanley Philippe, hosts of the I've Been Meaning to Listen to That podcast. They are with us today to talk about the second highest grossing worldwide movie of 1992, The Bodyguard. A seismic hit, Emily. Something that you really can't underplay how big this movie was.
Here's the interesting thing about this movie. It is, I actually remember the coverage of this at the time. It was a movie that was shown as like international box office is becoming more important because it's one of the few movies pre the 2000s that has a higher percentage of its box office worldwide than it does domestically. It's the 7th biggest movie in the US. It's the 2nd biggest in the world. It's probably because Whitney Houston's a global superstar and people wanted, but like that didn't work in the favor of movies starring Madonna. Although this movie has what was then the biggest song of all time.
The biggest movie soundtrack of all time, which we, Emily and I, are honored to do a companion episode with you guys on your podcast about the Bodyguard soundtrack. So we will not linger on that too much here.
I'm going to linger on it for a second.
And you have to let it linger.
we have to talk about it a little bit.
Because I love that your podcast. I've been meaning to listen to that. And I was like, hey, I want to do this because I've never listened to this album. And I watched this movie, and I have not listened to this album to the degree that I've only had heard two songs in it. And one of them was I Will Always Love You, which, you know, you can't escape. One of the big songs of all time. One of the great songs of all time. The other one was Queen of the Night, which I did not realize had lyrics beyond I'm the Queen of the Night. I thought that was the whole song.
Wait, you hadn't heard the other song?
No.
The I Have Nothing?
No. No, oh, Phil, so I grew
that
up
conservative.
I grew up conservative Christian. I grew up listening to country music and oldies.
Philippe's Stanley's face.
Sorry.
He's just shocked and appalled that yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm like almost like a physical podcaster where I express myself a lot, which is not great for podcasting because it's
no, it was a
platform.
Great face though. It was
wow, I had nothing but emotions in that moment. How did we have to talk about this on our podcast because okay. That is
we don't want
a huge revelation.
Yeah.
Huge. So it should be said that this is one of those movies that I oddly think both the movie and the soundtrack kind of fed each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were both huge. Like it really can't be understated that like there are big soundtracks. I mean, a movie that comes to mind that we talked about on our singles episode when we did that, Emily, the single soundtrack is a huge soundtrack. It was a soundtrack that did very, very well. A movie that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, it was a movie flop. Yeah.
Right. Movie flops. But the soundtrack, because grunge was sort of in its nascent what have you, that soundtrack was a big deal. At least me being the oldest person on this podcast was a big deal to me. So I say this just because you can find movies that have soundtracks that really pop, but the movies don't do that as well. So the fact that both of these exist, I think, is a testament to something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Emily, I don't disagree with you. I think this movie's kind of dog shit.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Yeah. Let's tear it down.
But,
let's kill well, people's
here's what's
heroes.
Funny. When you texted me, I had not finished the film yet. So Emily texts me. I'm like 40 minutes from the end of the film. And she's like, this movie fucking sucks. And I was like, listen, my roommate ran into our TV room to sing along with this, like, just couldn't like get enough of this movie. So clearly this movie means something to people.
It shouldn't.
It shouldn't. There's a camera gun.
They're wrong.
There's a camera yes. gun in this movie.
Thank you.
Genius.
I will say, like, if this was like a real Oscars, if that like really happened, it'd be on like number three on like a BuzzFeed listicle of like top 10 craziest Oscar moments.
It wouldn't be number one.
Yeah, like the slap and
slap,
then
yeah.
Jimmy Kimmel, like yeah. the switch off. Like
I can imagine being, you know, we do a lot of those Oscar listicles at Vox. I can imagine being at mm-hmm. Vox and trying to be like, so where does the attempted assassination of the best actress winner fall alongside the slap and the La La Land Moonlight mix up? You're just like,
oh.
I'm not sure.
It's I mean that Mala was pretty funny. It's like you gotta like give it that.
Because like when you texted me, Emily, I was kind of defending it a little bit because truth be told, the last 40 minutes of this film are so bug nuts. Like it goes so fucking crazy that like you can almost defend the first sort of hour of this film. Almost. I have my issues.
I want to just go around the horn on a question here. I'm going to start with our guests and circle back to you, Philip. I'm calling you Philip this episode. This thing we're doing.
Great. Okay.
Do you think Costner and Houston have any chemistry? I'm going to start with you, Andrew, and I want you, Stanley, and Harper to think about this question.
yeah, simmer this. I don't think they have chemistry, like romantic chemistry, but I do think that there is a metatextual element that's interesting of Kevin Costner really wanted Whitney Houston to do it. Like he was she was her top pick. And so there's like the metatextual element of like, oh shit, we got Whitney Houston to be in my movie. And then it's also Whitney Houston coming in her first acting gig and going, okay, I admire this guy as an actor. So there's like, it's not like a romantic spark, but it's like this admiration that's all very almost endearing to watch, but still a mess. Also,
All right, Stanley, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, here's the deal, y'all. Anytime you can include a sword in foreplay, it's either chemistry or a crime scene. And I don't think Whitney died there. So I'm going to say yes to chemistry. Yes.
Hell yeah. Harper, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that they are okay. So I find Whitney Houston to be so charming that I think that she could have at least some chemistry with like literally anyone. And I think that was really the big thing that was going on here. I was thinking a lot about Kevin Costner while watching this because I think I'm slightly too young to understand Kevin Costner as like a leading man, like sex symbol, right? Which I think he was in the late 80s, early 90s.
Very
like
much
that's,
so. Yeah.
You know, I'm a little too young to get it. Like, I recently watched Field of Dreams for the first time. And I was like, okay, like, he's like a hot liberal dad in Iowa, you know, like, that's cool. But, you know, and but I
have you seen Bull Durham?
I have not. And I need to because sports movies are like my one of my top genres. So I, that's on my Great list.
Movie. It's the horniest movie ever made.
Okay. But yeah, I said Bo Burnham and like my millennial brain was like, oh, nope, finally, nope. Something I can talk about.
Bull Durham's a great movie. I'm just, yes.
Yeah. It's definitely on my sports watch list. But yeah, so I feel like he does have something going on, but I just, yeah, it wasn't necessarily something that was happening between him and Whitney Houston. It's just that they both kind of have a thing.
Whitney Houston could have like a chemistry with like a bag of hair clippings. Yeah. So that was, yeah. Sorry, yeah, that was not worth interrupting that point.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Kevin Costner.
Yeah. Liberal Iowa farmer, incidentally, is my like my dream. So like that's my,
your type?
That's my next life husband.
I thought it was David Strathairn.
I love two things. I love liberal Iowa farmers and I love surprisingly liberal fishermen who live in New Orleans
Cajun,
and wear hats that say trout. Phil,
so can I chime in on this? Yeah, I was suspicious about their chemistry coming into this film because I don't feel like they're two people that I necessarily thought would have chemistry, and they do a good job of kind of hiding Whitney for a good like 10-12 minutes of this movie. Even like the first scene she's in, we don't see her. They do a really good job of sort of like obscuring her, building up to her reveal. And the first time they lock eyes, I was like, shit, there's something here. Mm-hmm. Like these two actually do have something. And then it kind of goes away. And then it kind of comes back in these kind of adorable scenes that they have together. The cute scenes are the ones that worked for me.
Yeah, when
it's trying to be steamy and hot, I'm like, the lady doth protest. But but when it's kind of endearing and genuine, I was like, this works for me. So I don't know.
I feel like when Kevin Costner has sex in real life, he makes sure he finds his light, and it's like the least erotic thing possible. Just like, I'm here. See?
He knows his angles.
Give me a key light on. I mean, there we go. I think you're right. They fully have chemistry, and when they do and don't is almost entirely on the script, which is a very strange script. And also the director is doing them no favors. So,
none.
Yeah. Anyway.
So I want to give a little bit of context for this, for our listeners, for the, I don't know, five people that have, we are the five people that have not seen The Bodyguard, for the record. Like that's the six people that have not seen this movie. But best-selling pop diva Rachel Maron, played by Whitney Houston, has a stalker whose obsession has risen to the level of disturbing threats. At the urging of her manager, Rachel hires former Secret Service agent Frank Farmer, a name that could not be more ridiculous, played by Kevin Costner as her bodyguard.
Another hot farmer.
Another hot farmer. Initially resented and treated with disdain for his hard-nosed security procedures, of which he fucking sucks at, Farmer soon becomes an integral part of Rachel's inner circle as they spend more time together. Client and protector become closer still. The Bodyguard opened on November 25th, 1992, against Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, Aladdin, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Malcolm X, and of course, The Mighty Ducks.
Yeah.
It would go on to make $411 million on a $25 million budget. It has 38% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 64% from audiences. Roger Ebert, however, Emily, gave this film three stars.
He liked it.
He liked this movie. He said the ads for The Bodyguard make it look like a romance, but actually it's a study of two lifestyles, of a pop star superstar whose fame and fortune depends on millions of fans, and a professional bodyguard who makes his living by protecting her from those fans. The movie does contain a love story, but it's the kind of guarded passion that grows between two people who spend a lot of time keeping their priorities straight. Sure. I mean, we need to talk about the script, Emily, because I think that the fundamental problems here stem from one of our greatest screenwriters, Lawrence Katz.
Yes.
A man who has many great credits to his name. Some big studio crazy movies, some smaller movies like The Big Chill. He kind of really can do it all. And this is an early script that he writes early in his career before he becomes anything.
He was a copywriter. Yeah.
He just kind of writes this thing. And the way he talks about this script, you would think he wrote fucking, I don't even, like Citizen Kane or something. Mm-hmm. He talks about how I loved all my early scripts. I expected everybody else to love them. It wasn't until I wrote The Bodyguard and sensed it was different that I realized I was writing an increased level of density. Density, Emily? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the density of this script?
Well, now that you put it that way, I realize it's perfectly structured in every way.
Well, these characters are kind of dense. Yeah.
By density, you mean there's too much going on.
Yeah.
Well,
it's I understand why this was a good spec for him. I could imagine this being good on the page. My cat's here. Look at that.
Yeah.
I can imagine,
and also good on the page in the early, like late 70s or
in like the yeah, when this is like an era when they're like this kind of movie, this romantic drama. This is, you know, the obvious analog for this is A Star Is Born, which has very similar elements.
Sorry, that was the sound of Emily's cat.
So, but like this like subgenre film, the romantic drama about, you know, with people of two different levels of like class. Or fame or whatever stratification you want to come up with is like a big deal in the 70s. So I could see like where he got a lot of heat from that. But like, it kind of by the 90s, he should have done a rewrite. I mean, I'm sure he did, but he should have maybe done a page one. That's all I'm saying. I just think maybe a page one.
What's interesting too, twofold. The first is, yes, everything you're saying, this was originally developed as a Steve McQueen, Diana Ross vehicle. Then it turns into a Ryan O'Neill, Diana Ross vehicle when they were dating. Then they break up. Shockingly, movie falls apart. And then it kind of goes away for a while. It's put on a shelf. And then it's redeveloped because Costner really loves this idea. And they redevelop it with other writers who try to kind of dial up the violence and to dial up some of the sort of the tension and what have you. And they feel like it gets too violent. So they literally go back to Kasdan's script, which is kind of just odd to me. And I really think it's Costner that's just like fucking full steam ahead on this thing. He just really wants to make it.
Yeah, I think the key word here is, I think the key word is vehicle, right? I think it was both a vehicle for Costner to continue to expand his dominance, because at the time he had all these amazing movies. He was the movie star, him and Tom Cruise,
huge
of movie stars in that kind of early 90s period. And then Costner also wanted to make sure he attached the biggest pop star at the time, which was Whitney Houston. So that vehicle, that the driving of these two massive stars, I think kind of came as a priority over any type of script that made any type of sense. Absolutely. And I think the highlights of the movie are related to when those two stars show, wait for it, chemistry. And also when they're allowed to do what they do best, which is either sing their hearts out or look awkwardly as someone is singing their hearts out, which is what Costner does really, really well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about Kevin Costner, so it's worth kind of just talking about where he is at this point in his career. I mean, I would argue he's at the potentially the most power he's ever had creatively. Dancing with Wolves comes out in 90, which he obviously wins Best Picture. It's a huge hit. He follows it up with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which was a big hit, a movie I have not rewatched since I was 11.
I want to say so I come under fire sometimes. I come on a show and I'm like, Bodyguard sucks. And people are like, but I love that movie. And then I'm like, dude, would you first see it? I was like, I'm 11. I'm like, you're wrong. You're wrong. And your 11-year-old self is
They're currently 11.
Okay. Yeah. So Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, it was my favorite movie of all time at that age. I rewatched it last year when I was home for maternity leave with my kid.
Don't say it.
Holds up.
So bad. So bad. I remember that, like, it was like my idea of what like romantic love was, like Kevin Costner and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio in that film,
and with Brian Adams playing in the
with Brian Adams playing in the background, and just like, no, not at all. Alan Rickman's still fun, but then you remember that the climax of that movie is a comedic rape scene, and you're like, not sure about that. Doesn't hold up. 11-year-old Emily, she's a fucking idiot too. So there we go.
So he follows up Robin Hood with a pretty crazy, I mean, he does JFK, yeah, which is a big fucking crazy swing. It only basically gets made because Kevin Costner decides he's going to do it. He puts all of his clout behind a paranoid Oliver Stone movie, which also makes a boatload of money. And then he makes The Bodyguard, which makes a boatload of money. And then it kind of gets away from him. I would argue that that's kind of the beginning
of the end. This is like the last one, right?
This is, well, because, I mean, it depends on what you want. Like, Tin Cup is fun.
It wasn't like a hit. You know, it wasn't like a smash. Yeah.
No, this is, I mean, basically the real nail in the coffin is Waterworld, infamously, obviously, this kind of big catastrophic thing. Which,
although, can I just mention real quick, based off of Emily's understanding of Costner's movie listings, maybe if we rewatch Waterworld, it'll be like the most epic, amazing. Because back then,
there are people that ride for Waterworld. There are people that ride.
Wild. That's wild. Yeah.
Listen. There was at one point I was like, "There's a Waterworld TV show," and I know some people who are working on it. And like, yes, I don't know if it's going to get picked up. I don't know anything about this. It's like a while back. So I was like, "I'm going to watch Waterworld." Pretty good. It's pretty good. Oh, pretty good.
I love it.
I think they can incorporate the spirit of the live action experience at Universal Studios, because the Waterworld show at Universal is amazing. Like, it's the best part of going there.
The thing about
Harper, you nailed it. I think Waterworld is still alive in people's consciousness because of that theme.
The thing about Waterworld, just we're only going to talk this last thing. We're going to end up with the Waterworld train, I promise. Is at the time it was released, people were like, a whole planet underwater, that's pretty far-fetched. Like, arguably, like, time has been very kind to Waterworld, and it's because we've been destroying the planet. So that's like the one good thing to come out of it, is now people like Waterworld.
Hey, there's a silver lining.
I mean, I also think people kind of like Waterworld because, and this maybe this is a bit of a stretch, but I still think, is the Mad Max of it all. I think that Mad Max, it has a very Mad Max on water vibe. That's kind of basically what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that Fury Road got people back into sort of Mad Max headspace. And I think, I don't know, I just feel like Waterworld has this kind of, I also think because it wasn't like actually that big a failure is the thing people also don't remember. Like, yes, this movie, it cost $260 million, which is insane in 1995. Because, spoiler, they shot the whole fucking thing on water. So it's impossible to make that on a reasonable budget. They also like kind of shot it twice, and the director was like fired, and there was all kinds of shit that went on. But like, this movie still made almost $200 million. So like, they didn't make all their money back, but like, it didn't sink a studio. It wasn't the type of thing that was truly catastrophic. It's also the same director of your favorite movie, Emily, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Listen.
Mel Brooks?
No, yeah. Absolutely.
Yep.
Listen, Kevin Costner made sure that Kevin Reynolds just kept working. And like, for that, we can thank him, I guess. He also like had him direct that Hatfields and McCoys miniseries that like,
he did. They must be
Kevin
close.
Solidarity.
The thing, yeah. I mean, their names are Kevin. I feel like if your name is Kevin, you know all the other Kevins
their
and
names
your friends.
Are Kevin. You're Kevin. I'm Kevin.
You know,
are we best friends?
You know how like, yeah. It's very important. It's very important to like understand that humans are complex and they are not reduced to any single element of their identity, except for people named Kevin. They're all named Kevin, and it's very important to them.
So, I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't talk for a second about the director of this film, Mick Jackson. Now, Mick Jackson has only made 7 movies in his career. LA Story comes out in 91, which is a pretty big hit, the Steve Martin movie.
That's a good movie.
Steve Martin wrote. It is a good movie. It's a little dated, but it's a good movie. He makes this in 92, and then he makes a little movie called Clean Slate, which I'm sure you guys are not aware of. It was the Dana Carvey vehicle.
I'm not even aware of that.
He's a private investigator who has amnesia, and he forgets things.
Oh, no.
Memento?
Hope he does well at his job.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so he does that, and that movie is, as you can imagine, a big old flop. And then he makes Emily's favorite volcano movie, Volcano.
Hey. I think I prefer Dante's Peak.
Volcano?
Dante's Peak is better than Volcano. Yeah, I'm kidding. Yeah. That was a shot in the dark.
Yeah. But here's Phil's theory of my movie taste. if he doesn't like it, but he doesn't like it in a way where he's like, this is disastrous. He's like, Emily might like this. I got a 50-50 shot.
I'm sad. 50-50 shot is a pretty good ratio. I feel like if I just take a swing, I'm probably going to hit it half the time. Volcano is the movie where
you do know me pretty well.
where a volcano grows out of the center of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And the only two people to fight it are Tommy Lee Jones and Ann Hesh, who kind of have no romantic chemistry.
Well, that's a shock.
Harper, you feel like you have thoughts on Volcano.
I do. I grew up in LA. So for me, like seeing them blow up the Beverly Center so that they could redirect the lava down Wilshire is like so fundamental to my being.
The dream of yours.
Yeah. I think about it all the time. So I will always love Volcano for that.
I rewatched Volcano, I want to say about a year ago, maybe less. And it is really fun to watch. Now that I've lived in LA for, 18 years, crazily enough. First of all, it's a different LA. It's an LA from 1997, where like the Beverly Center was actually a place people went. And to see the city in this weird mid-90s kind of view while it's getting melted by molten lava is fun. I can't.
I want to stay on this topic for a little bit. Andrew Stempley, please. I don't believe you have any history with LA, but what are your feelings on the Beverly Center? Just tell me everything you think about it.
Love it. I think it's great.
Can we talk about the Beverly Center for a while? Because I can. I'm ready. The vibes are off there.
I like how
they
it centers Beverly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they really should. And the thing is, they keep trying to renovate it, but they only just keep like adding things to it. But it's so old and shitty and has no windows.
Yeah.
So whenever you're in there, it's like you're in a bunker.
Have
they tried adding a volcano to it? That might actually... help. I don't know.
Great.
Just a thought.
My baby was born at Cedars-Sinai, which is right by the Beverly Center. Sure. And and she was in the NICU for a little while. She's fine. She's great. She's great. She's wonderful.
She's but, great. I went, she's lovely.
Yeah. I went and wandered around the Beverly Center for a while some days when I was just like, I'm done being in the hospital. It's like a fucking it's like a habit trail for humans. It's like yes! Just like little like hamster wheat holes and stuff. And like half the stores are empty. You can kind of like go in and wander around. It's great. It's everyone awful. Should go. It's the best mall.
It is. Yeah. Sorry. Please go ahead.
No, I was going to say this is a really bad joke, but it's like if you go to this mall, it's so stupid, and you order a dessert and it's lava cake. Do people go, hey, whoa, 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 too soon? Too soon.
All the time. All the time.
Just check.
That was worth it. I'm supportive.
It was worth it. Also, there is no way that there is any establishment that sells a lava cake at the Beverly Center.
Fair enough.
No, you have to go across the street to the Beverly Connection, where there used to be a soup plantation.
Of course.
Yeah, and a Baja Fresh. I mean, it's just great. Yeah, I mean, the Beverly Center is terrible. I feel like there has been innumerable movies shot at the Beverly Center.
What are your thoughts on soup plantation?
I think the name is problematic.
It's extremely problematic.
The first word, soup. Okay. Yeah. Soup. Now we're cooking with gas. Second word. So.
I think, they went out of business early in the pandemic.
They did, yeah.
And like, I just like, I miss the concept of a soup and salad like bar buffet thing. It was a wonderful place to go. They would have had to change the name. I think they should reboot.
Reboot Soup Plantation. I think this is your chance.
I'm gonna call it Soup Patrol.
You ever heard like it's you ever hear those?
Oh no! Oh no! Yes, I was just gonna say I could tell you exactly the day that they all closed because I made an Instagram post where I had almost identical plates of salads that I had built at Soup Plantation. It was May 7th, 2020 when I said RIP Soup Plantation.
RIP.
They did also early
in the pandemic.
Yeah, it was early. I mean, they were in decline. Yeah.
I think Soup Plantation was dangling by a thread and COVID just...
Oh, yeah.
You know what? I will say, like, Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively shouldn't have gotten married at that Soup Plantation.
It was a long walk, but it was worth it.
Just my stance. I don't know.
You mentioned Harper... how charismatic Whitney Houston is. Just a pivot away where we've been. the Soup Plantation bit was great. Whitney Houston surprisingly didn't act very much. And I imagine, I mean, listen, Whitney Houston had a tragic, brutal life, it seems. So I don't mean to make light of that, but she was also making music. So, you know, you have a lot of these pop stars that would try to balance the two things. Madonna obviously did that, you know, for a while and what have you. But I looked at her filmography. It's The Bodyguard, it's Waiting to Exhale, The Preacher's Wife, which I've never seen. Is it good?
Oh my gosh, it's so good. Yeah, I do a Christmas okay. series. I did talk about it on my Christmas series. It's wonderful. It's a remake of an old movie called The Bishop's Wife. Sure. And then this one has Denzel Washington as an angel. And I mean, that doesn't get any better than that. It's really good.
I like it too as a Christmas movie aficionado. I do think one of the problems with it is the stakes have decreased. When you do a remake, you want to increase the stakes. A bishop, mm-hmm. much more powerful than a preacher. It should have been like The Pope's Wife. That's what it should have been.
Can I just say that I love that Emily knows the power structure? Like, who's more powerful within the rankings of religion? I love that about you, Emily.
The arch-curate's wife.
Well, it's a ring to it.
It really just rolls off the tongue. I've never seen Preacher's Wife. We talked about it very briefly, Emily, when we were doing our Malcolm X episode of all things, mm-hmm. because we were talking about how Denzel very, very infrequently does anything close to a rom-com. Mm-hmm. And I need to watch Preacher's Wife because it feels like he's quite good in it. And it's a shame that he didn't do that more or hasn't done that more.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
What else is, are those all the Whitney movies or did she?
Then she does the Cinderella.
We're going to eventually cover it on our show. That, it seems.
I'm going to say I was born in 1994. Cinderella came out in 1997. I had it on VHS. I watched it possibly every day. It is so impossible. Yes, yeah. It's so important to me. And it's not just Cinderella. It's Whitney Houston Presents Cinderella. Like, this is her project. You know, she developed
it. It's a presentation.
Yes, she is the fairy godmother. It's a perfect movie. Absolutely zero notes.
Just to take notes for our Wikipedia people, I believe that Harper is the second person on this miniseries born after the events of this miniseries.
Correct.
1995.
Yeah. I'm sorry to make you contemplate a time before you were born, because I always hate doing that.
So it should be said, and this, I don't mean this as a humble brag, my cousin directed that Cinderella film. I'm sure he'll be thrilled to hear how much you love it. Wow. I tried to watch it. I don't think it's very good, but that's great.
Is he the she's all that cousin?
That's the same guy.
Wow. Phil, let's get him on the show.
From Justin,
I would gladly
Kelly?
Have him on the show.
Whoa.
That's what ended his career.
A classic.
Can I tell you, I'm going to tell you a little story here very briefly.
I don't want to talk about The Bodyguard. Let's do it. Go for it.
Well, I know you don't, but we have to, and we will, but I'm going to tell this very brief story. Basically what happened was my cousin directs She's All That. It's a big hit. It's a Miramax movie. And they're trying to get a musical up on its feet. He also was the choreographer. He did the choreography for Jesus Christ Superstar. He's Canadian, as you can imagine, since I am. Norman Jewison did that film, and he did a bunch of films with Norman Jewison. Long story short, he gets to do She's All That. It's a big hit. Miramax is trying to get Chicago up on its feet, and they're like, we would love you to direct Chicago. And he's like, I will absolutely direct Chicago, but I'm just going to go do this little movie first called From Justin to Kelly, and then... That was the end of the road. So, you know, these are the choices we make in our career.
that's like playing a volcano in downtown LA and thinking it would work out. So wild.
It is. It is. Wild. Yeah. Okay. But putting it actually in the middle of your career.
Yeah. With no Tommy Lee Jones to rescue you.
With no Tommy Lee Jones or Anne Hesh around, and it's just a disaster.
Yeah. Okay.
But all this being said, to pivot us back to the film that we're talking about today, Emily, the movie that you love, you know, stop pretending you don't love it. The reason I brought up the Whitney Houston of it all is because I think she's actually very good in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think she has really good timing. I think she's just good. She's bringing gravity to a pretty crappy script. I think she's doing a good job. I've never seen Waiting to Exhale. Has anyone seen Waiting to Exhale on here?
I guess I've watched every Whitney Houston movie. I didn't realize.
I've seen that movie, Phil. I've seen Waiting to Exhale. How have I seen it? I don't know, but I have. It's very good.
Is it good?
Very good.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that soundtrack Granted, I haven't listened to the Bodyguard soundtrack at all. I'm just going to say that soundtrack's better, though. Although I like the Whitney songs from Bodyguard soundtrack, but I went and looked at the track listing. There's a bunch of other shit on there. And, you know, I don't know how I'm going to feel about that. I know I like the Waiting to Exhale soundtrack. I don't know.
That's a really great way to tee up our episode on the Bodyguard soundtrack.
Well, the thing is, I haven't listened to it, and that's the premise of the show. So
coming like a few days after this episode, so check that out on our show.
It's gonna be great. I think it's gonna be great. I have not listened to it to completion as well. Like I've only heard the Whitney songs here and there. So, you know, I will press play and listen to the entire thing before we do our podcast. But, you know.
Well, like, could I like since we're talking about Whitney, like, could I like present like a take I'm gestating, it's not quite cooked yet, but like, sure. I feel like Whitney, like you're talking about her appeal and how her screen presence really works, like she is kind of proto Beyonce and proto Taylor at the same time a little bit, like proto Beyonce in like the very superficial reasons, you know, the race and gender thing, but also Beyonce and Whitney have this unknowable mystique to them. Sure. Like, and then to borrow Emily's point about Taylor, they're like Taylor and Whitney both peddle intimacy as if she's your friend, but also like comes off like an alien who's never interacted like with a human being ever in her life, you know, like that's Emily's point. And like about Taylor, and they both, so it's like really compelling to watch, but there's also this unknowable quality to them too. It's like, it's really, so there's like, she's acting as herself, but not herself at the same time. It's really fascinating.
I was thinking about if you were going to remake this movie now, who you would remake.
Which they are.
I know, but like if you were like actually going to remake it and not just like put it on fucking Paramount Plus or whatever they're going to do with it.
They did do like, what's it called? Beyond the Lights. That movie is this movie with social realism and actual takes on race and mental health and stuff.
That's one of my favorite movies of that, whatever year that was. If you were going to make this now, you'd almost have to do it with like Taylor Swift or Beyonce. And like
Addison Rae.
Interesting.
Taylor Swift is, Addison Rae, obviously, or Charli D'Amelio. Charli D'Amelio would be the person you want. No, well, I mean, like Taylor Swift can't act. Beyonce's range is limited. Beyonce's fine, but like I don't know that, you know, the thing about,
I don't think she could do it now, like she could probably do it early
in her
about career.
Thing about Whitney Houston doing this at this point in time is it is kind of a surprise that she's not a surprise, but it's like her first role and everybody's waiting for pop stars to bomb when they make a movie, and sure. She comes in, she's
Glitter, anybody?
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic, but let's not stay on that. I've actually never seen it. So I think she comes in and she's pretty good. And people are like, hell yeah, good for you. And like, it's so easy for a pop star to come in and just bomb on their first movie. She kind of nails it, but she's also kind of playing herself, to Andrew's point, which I think helps. Yeah.
I think that, first of all, I agree with everything you guys are saying. And I also feel like Hollywood always has its knives sharpened for any musician that's trying to be an actor. It feels as though they don't want them to succeed. Like, stay in your fucking lane unless you're going to be incredible. And then it's undeniable and we have no choice but to welcome you in with open arms, a la a Lady Gaga or something along those lines, where they feel as though it's sort of like, okay, well, I guess, sure. I don't know what the sort of landscape was like when Whitney was doing this in 92, but my guess is that they were not thrilled. Do you know what
they
I mean?
They gave her seven, they gave the movie and her like Razzies, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Which, Emily, I didn't know you were giving out Razzies back then. So that's awesome.
I did. I'm actually on the board.
You were
the
president back then.
That's why, you know, at the time I did change my last name. I used to be Emily Razzie. And
right, but you just made your daughter's middle name.
My daughter's name Golden Raspberry St. James. No, I actually put that on the wiki. That's what we'll call her from now on. Golden Raspberry.
Golden Raspberry.
I think I don't like this movie, but I think I hate the Razzies on principle. And I looked at the things they nominated and I was like, those are all like, I don't know why you're doing this. The thing that's wrong with this movie is the director. He just doesn't quite understand the material and the script is a mess. And you can never overcome those two things when you're making a movie. But all the people in it are doing a good job. And there's like some good songs. And like occasionally the camera points at the right thing and shoots it in the exact right way that you'd like. And you're like, I can see things.
Yeah.
And occasionally,
oh, the subjects.
Yeah. 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 There's, but yeah, it's sort of indifferently filmed and it just can't overcome that.
So, there were a couple other people that were put in the conversation. I know that, you know, Kevin Costner had, you know, blocked his sights on Whitney Houston, but there were other people that were considered. Pat Benatar, Olivia Newton-John, Madonna. Oh. Debbie Harry, Joan Jett, and Janet Jackson.
Of that group, Madonna could work, Janet Jackson could work. I think the others are just they're just not big enough, you know.
I fully agree. Madonna, apparently, Kevin Costner wouldn't even meet with her because she had a joke at his expense in Madonna Truth or Dare, and he was like, fuck that person. So I don't know what the Madonna version of this is in 92 because she's in her erotica phase, and it's like, I'm sure she would have been, she would have swallowed the entire picture. Like, it's not a Lawrence Kasdan script anymore. Like, it just would have turned into an entirely different thing. But to your point, Emily, that thing could have worked, not to the same extent. I want to bring something up that I don't quite know the answer to because I wasn't paying attention to these things in 1992. And unfortunately, a lot of people weren't, but this is an interracial couple in 92. And, you know, I imagine that was unfortunately probably a pretty big deal in 92. And yet, I imagine that's part of the secret sauce of the success of this film. I'm curious what you guys think about that.
I do try and research contemporary writing about it. And to the extent that I did, I found a few things written about it. But it was always just sort of in a passing, like, Hollywood is getting more okay. Interracial love on screen. It was like articles about that. I couldn't find like there was anybody like upset about this or that there was controversy.
Right.
There, you know, there may have been that the monoculture sort of kept terrible people from getting the mic in the way that we see right now. But I did notice as I was looking for through the tags of this movie on IMDb, the top like five or six are all like specifically about interracial love story so that's like user generated things that they're saying, I'm putting this in my list of whatever. That comes up all the time. So it is interesting. I do think there's something in that driving. I mean, obviously the primary driver of success is it has two of the biggest stars in the world at that time and they're falling in love, but there is something to that, I think.
Yeah. And they never really play into it, right? Like there was never a point where, you know, Whitney or any of her team was like, oh, this white bodyguard is going to come and protect me. Like, what does he know about protecting a black superstar? And then there was never a point where Kevin Costner's like, oh my God, I'm falling in love with this black superstar. You know, they never really played into it at any point. It's as if race didn't really matter. And it's interesting, Philip, when you say all the lists of names that were considered, like they were not all black superstar singers, right? So I don't think that was actually a consideration in making the movie. I was thinking about the Taylor comparison because Taylor's concert movie was so big because it gave people a chance to first see her that couldn't go see her live, but also it gave people an audience a chance to get together and sing the songs. And I think back in 1992, I mean, you didn't have Twitter or Instagram or any of that kind of stuff. So the way you congregated was in church or at the movies. And this gave people a chance to congregate and sing along to Whitney. And so I think that the race part wasn't as important as the music was. And Whitney at that point was already arguably the biggest singer of her generation. So that vehicle of getting her voice versus not understanding the racial part of who that voice is, I think really played harder than anything else.
Two points to that. Like, first of all, thank God there wasn't Twitter when Whitney was famous, because there would have been like tweets about like speculating about her sexuality and stuff like that. But it's also like, I watched the behind the scenes of this movie, and the writer Lawrence Kasdan was like, why is there no, like, yeah, like we didn't add like a line of pointing it out, the interracial quality of the relationship, because one, we just weren't equipped to do it. Second of all, like They kept like dancing around it, like her racist star, like that's a line they say in the behind the scenes thing. And it's, but then it also like leaks out in weird ways. Like we're not going to talk about. And then there's that weird line about the black chauffeur. Like such an odd line. And you know, it's like it's very strange.
Yeah, I think I took more umbrage with the relationship that he had with the young black guy than I did with his relationship with Whitney, because the whole like taking this young black man under his wing and tutelage and I just all that just felt very kind of like tropey and awful, but like very reminiscent.
The 90s is also really the height of this era. Well, actually, I shouldn't say the height, because the height is like specifically the 6 months after we elected Barack Obama. But like that's the height of people being like, America has solved race and we're over it and we're fine. And like, obviously we hadn't. The 90s have so many terrible racist things that happen. America has so many fucking problems. But the 90s are this time when you make a movie like this and then you act like not talking about it at all in the press is like kind of a bold move. And it, to be clear, it is a little bit, but also like, you know, you could have like Lawrence Kasdan, you could have like talked to somebody and like, you know, done the research. I don't know.
It is strange. I mean, it seems to me as though what we have perceived from 2023 is they didn't talk about it. They just pretended, quote unquote, as though it was just normal. Like, this is fine. No big deal. Whatever.
Yeah.
Which I think we perceive as courageous when really it was probably just kind of laziness and kind of not wanting to step on any landmines.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to kind of give them their flowers for it. But at the same time, sure. I mean, it's very strange. It's a weird kind of situation.
Maybe they read their own script and thought, man, we can't even write this movie about a bodyguard. Imagine if you try putting like race into the conversation, like it'd be like Kevin Costner seeing Whitney Houston for the first time and be like, oh, you're black, you know, like it'd be that type of writing, you know what I mean? So I think in hindsight they were brilliant in staying away from race and just making the most confusing weird script plot twist of all time, but with a killer soundtrack, you know.
It's, you know, it's funny, but before we get into the plot of this, I do just want to bring up something that I don't even know if this is an urban legend at this point, but because I just don't know how much credence to give this, but apparently Kevin Costner contacted Princess Diana about a sequel. She apparently agreed to this sequel. There was apparently a script written and it arrived the day before her death in 97. Fuck.
This is like how Eric Roth started writing Forrest Gump 2 on September 10th, 2001. And you're like, okay.
it's exactly the same thing.
Kevin Costner has said this in interviews. That's where it comes from. I know, however, that Kevin Costner sometimes just says shit. You know, he's one of those actors. And so like people
would be like, Iowa dad.
Yeah. You know, he says things. He's like trying to manifest a thing into being. Where nobody can call him on it. And like, I don't give it a lot of credence. I cannot imagine that Princess Diana was going to make a bodyguard sequel.
I mean, it's crazy on so many levels.
It comes up in The Crown season 6.
it's crazy for so many reasons.
The penultimate episode.
It better be in the second part of the sixth season, like at the very beginning.
It's like,
they're like, and she was gonna do a bodyguard.
It just like you could just like they should end an episode with like Princess Di goes home. She's like, I'm up to go to the shower. I'm going to use the bathroom, which we call the loo because it's Britain. And then like the door like there's a messenger and he lays a package on and dolly in and it says the bodyguard 2. And then like, you know, Candle in the Wind 97 starts playing because you know she's about to die. Cut to credits. This is why I'm a working screenwriter.
So by the way, I have literally just watched the last episode of the first part of season 6 last night, so I can say that doesn't happen. But
missed opportunity.
It is a huge missed opportunity. I only bring this up because this does feel like fan fiction inside Kevin Costner's head. And I guess my question is, what makes him think that anyone wants to see that movie? Princess Diana had never acted, had never shown any interest in acting. There was no possible way that she would want to make this movie. On top of the fact that he's a bad bodyguard. If this movie's proven anything, he's inept at this. So the idea that anybody else would want to hire him, let alone, you know, the ex-Princess of Wales, I just find the whole thing just really absurd. And then to your point, Emily, it almost feels like him saying, yeah, and the script showed up the day before she died, all feels so concocted. It just feels crazy.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I wrote a movie for Gregory Peck, and it showed up the day before he died. And
yeah,
you can never prove it. It was what
Cape Fear 2?
It's Cape Fear 2. more fear, more cape.
More fear, more cape.
Can I use the restroom really quickly? I just need to take two minutes, like a very fact. Yeah.
Okay.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So Emily, have you not watched? Have you watched any of The Crown final season?
No, I haven't watched The Crown since season 2.
Oh,
really?
I watched like the first several of season 2, and I was like, "This is good," and I never need to watch more. Like, I'm not anti Crown. I'm just like, I got the taste of it, and I was like, okay. And then like people were not so hot on season 3, so I was like, well, I don't need to come back. Season 4, of course, won all the Emmys. I actually watched a couple episodes of that. Libby, Emma Corrin is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then I just was like, I don't need to come back, you know? So,
you know, I have a weird history with the show as well. My roommate is a fucking hardcore Crown person.
That's weird, because you're from Canada where you're ruled by the queen, is my understanding.
The king.
Well, I mean, at the time, when you were living there, you were ruled by the queen. Now.
It's true. It's true. I'll just say this very quickly before we get back to the actual podcast. But I'll just say that my roommate's very much into The Crown. The show drops. Season 1 drops. She unhinges her jaw and watches the whole thing in like, you know, 12 hours or whatever it was. And she's like, you have to watch this. You have to watch this. I was like, I don't fucking care. I don't care about the royals. Like, I don't care. Mm. And then for whatever reason, I eventually watch. I'm like, fuck, this is actually a good show. So I watch all of season 1. Then season 2 drops. And again, I'm sort of like, I don't really care. And she's like, why aren't you watching this show? I watch season 2. I'm like, this show's really good. Then season 3 drops. To your point, Emily, everyone's like, kind of come see, come saw. And they're sort of like, it's not that great. My roommate's like, yeah, it's not that great. I'm like, okay, great. I'm done. I don't have to watch The Crown anymore. But then season 4 is coming. And I'm like, but it's Princess Diana. So I should probably watch season 3. And there's some great episodes in season 3, but it is kind of a mixed bag. 4 is great. 5's a mess. 6 has been bumpy. So we'll see. But that is my story about The Crown. To talk about The Bodyguard. Back to The Bodyguard. We're gonna
all like dying to like give this movie our flowers. So
we're all really I know. But I do feel like we do need to hit some stuff about it. But we're gonna talk about the soundtrack on your podcast. But I do just want to say, as of 2015, over 37 million albums sold. The film has the best-selling soundtrack of all time. Saturday Night Fever is second with 10 million fewer albums sold. That's how big the gap is. Like, this thing fucking ran the, it's absolutely insane.
I ask, I assume on your show, we'll talk a lot more about like your favorite soundtracks of all time. I want to ask on our show, What's a movie where you like the sound, you love the soundtrack, you can't remember the movie at all? Like the soundtrack is like a thing that you just like can't.
That's a good question.
My answer for a long time was Dumb and Dumber, although I loved that movie. But like the soundtrack was huge for me. And like I just listened to it over and over and over again. Similarly, the Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet. Again, loved the movie, but like the soundtrack for like 2 years of my teens was like all I listened to. But I don't think those are good answers because I do like both those movies.
Yeah, it's tough because like generally
Space Jam. Okay, go ahead.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. That's actually a good answer. Because I'm not really drawn to a soundtrack unless I like the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially with like a movie like this where I listen to I Will Always Love You and I think, ah, yes, Frank Farmer.
So I do for the needle drop of I Will Always Love You happens technically twice in this movie. The first is there's like a honky tonk version that they slow dance to, which is cute. And then
chemistry.
I do like that scene. That's
chemistry. And then obviously the big one is she stops a plane from taking off.
Amazing.
She runs off of her private jet. Runs into his arms. They have this amazing kiss while the camera spins around them. And I got to be honest, it fucking works. It shouldn't work, but it works.
Song. The song makes it work.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
I know, but it's also the moment is what makes it work.
I'm not like saying like, obviously the song exists and all of that. Like it does work. I'm just like, I think that you could put literally anything under that song and it would work. Like other people have done it and you're like, yep, works every time. Are you familiar with the Dolly Parton version? Because
it's phenomenal.
I like came in when I saw like the trailer or whatever for this movie, like I was like, that's Dolly Parton, that's a Dolly Parton song. And I was like, and then of course it became huge and I was like, but I think most people, and rightly so, associate the song with Whitney Houston because her version is the peerless classic. But like, yeah, there's some, I remember like Dolly Parton like apparently like signed the rights over and was just like whatever, and then like heard it on the radio one day and was like, is that my song? This is really good.
Yeah, she literally had to pull over.
Yeah,
she was like, I heard this and I was like, Jesus Christ, you just fucking like lapped me. Like I mean, you're not wrong, Emily, that this song works under really any circumstances, but this movie does weaponize it pretty perfectly in terms of that moment.
You could put it under a scene of Jeff and the Dean in Community and it would work.
Like, I think it was, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
But anyway, I do want to say, like,
Princess Di in The Crown, like reading the Bodyguard 2 script.
Yeah.
Stanley, go ahead.
That's exactly what happened. RIP Diana. We miss you. I think what's cool too is that rewatching it, you're waiting for that moment.
Yeah.
You know, like as cheesy as some parts were and as badly written it was, you still know you have this payoff moment that's coming at the end of this movie. So no matter how enjoyable or not enjoyable the rewatch was, you will always love the ending because you will always have this song and that moment. Like Whitney fucking Houston stops a plane. You know, like, like only Whitney Houston in 1992 can stop a plane. You know, not even Taylor Swift can do this in 2023. You know, like that's some star power.
Those planes keep going.
They have to get to Brazil or wherever else she's performing. So it was super cool to rewatch that moment and know the buildup and still feel something in that moment.
If Taylor Swift made this movie, she would be on the plane and she would be like, "Stop the plane, but actually run the engines faster so we do more CO2 emissions." Sorry.
Wow.
I thought she was your best friend.
I love Taylor Swift, and we are indeed best friends. But she probably needs to rethink her jet fuel consumption.
There were two things I was going to say. The first is there's an amazing bit of behind the scenes trivia about this scene and this shot, which is that when they're doing the shot around them, that the centrifugal force was so extreme it threw the camera operator off of the camera. They were doing it so quickly. And that was the take they used. Like this guy just threw it off the camera, which I think is fucking incredible, and I wish that there were footage of that. Second thing I was going to say is this is when the movie ends. Right now, in this kiss, I do not need to see her on a stage singing it, and I sure as fuck don't need to see him behind some fucking bishop holding a cross and then a freeze frame. What the fuck are they doing?
They're teasing the body. They're teasing the Bodyguard expanded universe, which also includes the bishop's wife, but actually they had to change it to the preacher's wife.
The preacher's wife.
That's right.
And, just, and the Hitman's Bodyguard, that movie too. Like throw that in there.
I got gobsmacked by it. I was like, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm, why do I give a fuck that he's now a bodyguard for some, like, what?
And it also like undercuts, like, I feel like what this movie does, what I like about this movie is it's like a metaphor for a relationship in that a bodyguard would be appealing to someone who doesn't really have anything to live for. In exchange, you get a nice salary to buy as many much orange juice and samurai swords as you want, you know? So, but if you...
Oh God, the orange juice.
Because that's all he cares about. It's orange juice and samurai swords.
But if you and Kurosawa, like watching those movies 62 times. Sure. But if you love someone, you have someone to live for, you have someone you would die for, and they would die for you, and your job is to provide security and safety. And it's also like dysregulating when that security is threatened. So when he when the movie ends and he's a bodyguard still to someone else, it's like, oh, he didn't learn anything. Who cares? You know, it's like, it's really like, I don't know. He doesn't really learn shit in this movie. He's like, you think he'd be more sensitive and more like caring and loving now that he's like found love, but he's like really just like dealing with this in like a very toxic masculine way. And it's like really like, I can't root for this guy.
My strong preference in romantic love dramas is that the couple is not together at the end. I think that the tragedy of a love that is lost is kind of like a really great, like one of my favorite movies is Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Like that ending to me is perfect. Mm-hmm. And like, this is just because I'm a bummer, even though I've been married for fucking forever. I just am like, love doesn't work. Nobody should try it.
Cool.
But I don't know why they're not together at the end of this movie. It makes no sense that they're not. And the movie would be stronger if she stopped the plane and ran off and was like, I'm going to be with you. And then she's singing and she's pointing at him in the crowd. And he's like, it's me. I'm the bodyguard. And like, cut to credits.
It's our song.
So it ends on a freeze frame of Kevin Costner's face out of focus over a guy's shoulder.
It's a crazy ending.
Vintage.
Not to mention the fact that the shot of Whitney is a tight on her face as she's singing it from God knows where. We don't even have any context for it. It truly felt like they didn't know not even how to end the movie, but like what footage they use to end this movie with. It's pretty unbelievable. I also think, like, just to kind of jump through some of the plot here, I mean, this movie opens with Frank having gunned down a bunch of people. Like the title card is, he's shot a whole bunch of people. We don't really know the circumstances. We never find out the circumstances. He's offered to be this guy's permanent bodyguard, and he's like, no, I'm not interested. That's the other thing too. He's like this kind of like lone wolf. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what Frank's deal is. It's very strange.
Bodyguard.
Sure. So when he's brought to
this LinkedIn looks like, it's like the bodyguard. That's like his title, and then it's just like I was a bodyguard for the following people. I'm gonna go bug him on LinkedIn right now. Continue talking, Phil.
Do it. So basically, he goes to Whitney's house. Her manager is asking him to be her permanent bodyguard. He walks him around. Okay. I don't understand the intercom bit. It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand why her intercom for her house doesn't work, but okay. He very easily gets into the house because there's clearly no security of this massively successful person. They walk him around the house. They tell him that someone broke in and masturbated on her bed, which is a no-no. And yet, apparently, no one seems to be particularly upset about it or worried about it. There's a bunch of ransom notes. There's a sequence where I see the stalker is watching, like, Entertainment Tonight or something, and making ransom notes like he's the Riddler or something.
Yeah,
it's the
vile serial killer, the Snowman,
or the Zodiac killer.
Yeah, it's.
Has anybody seen the Satoshi Kon movie Perfect Blue, which literally yes. does that yes. sequence, like shot for yes. shot, I think. But like, you're like, Perfect Blue, it somehow makes more sense. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like,
no, it makes absolutely more. And then Aronofsky rips off Perfect Blue for Black Swan. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, there are frames that he literally ripped off in Black Swan.
So, as we know, Mick
most
Jackson.
Most influential.
Yeah.
Movie.
Most influential. Movie. Yeah.
Who knew that The Bodyguard actually influenced Perfect Blue and Black Swan? I mean,
it's getting better and better. This movie is getting better.
It is. I mean, it's going up. We then see there's a pan shot, and I don't know if you guys clocked this, and maybe this is me reading too much into this, as Lawrence Kasdan said, dense text. Mm-hmm. But there's a shot where we see the Metropolis robot from the Fritz Lang movie.
Okay.
Which looks decidedly similar to the metal outfit that Whitney wears when she's doing that concert. And I'm trying in my brain to understand if these two things are actually connected or if Mick Jackson was just like, I like Metropolis. Like, I just, maybe I'm reading
the
too much
thing
into it.
About all of the movies at the Oscars at the end of this is that they, you can't, like, their titles or stuff. Queen of the Night appears to be a Rachel Mallon, like, it appears to be a concert movie about her, but somehow she wins Best Actress. So you know there's like stuff. So maybe it's a musical version of Metropolis. In my brain, that is what it is. Yeah,
I'm in. I mean, that being said, I just found myself just being like, I don't really know what this connection is, but fine.
By the way, that metal like body plate she wears is like a bodyguard. So that's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It is. That whole concert, riot, I guess, or whatever sort of transpires.
Yeah.
I'm not a bodyguard. I don't really know anything about security, really? But I can tell you that's not a secure concert venue. That is not a good idea.
Like, there is like this thing where, like, when you are a star of that level and you have these enormous concerts, it's like virtually impossible to make them 100% safe. So it is always amazing to me how many concerts we have of that size on this planet across like the last 50 years or whatever. And like the number that have descended into chaos is very small and they're all like legendary. It's kind of wild if you think about it, that this doesn't happen all the time. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. That scene in this did make me think about how susceptible a lot of these artists are to situations like this, but more so than anything, how susceptible Rachel is to this, because she has no competent security team. She's got one guy named Tony, who I recognize the actor from Dumb and Dumber and Goodfellas, and he's always fun. He doesn't seem like a guy who really knows what he's doing. She's got a manager who's trying to keep her safe and a PR guy who's literally willing to throw her into oncoming traffic if it means that, you know, it'll sell. It's a very strange... This movie has one thing it has to do as far as I'm concerned, which is be good bodyguards. Be competent at bodyguarding. And yet it fails at that one mission as far as I'm concerned, and I could never shake
in Bodyguards, because I always like to defend people. So in the Bodyguards defense, Whitney did give the old like, no, you shall not pass, like
she did
to her bodyguards, to her bodyguard, as more bodies are getting on stage and he's like, can I guard yours? And she's like, no, and then
she does do that. And then she's pulled in like they're orcs or something.
Yeah, yeah. And then Kevin Costner, he showed off, because he's just like, oh, okay, I'm going to pick you up and use my legs of steel to knock people off you. I mean, that was bodyguarding 101.
That, as a sometimes straight woman, that's fucking hot.
Do you have thoughts?
The poster with like him carrying her is really hot too. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, like, I feel also, so they do establish that he doesn't work with celebrities usually. Like, he usually works with, like, politicians or, I think, like, or what?
Bishops.
Or bishops, yeah. And I, you know, I do think there is, like, a totally different set of skills you probably, or, like, things to assess, like, threats, potential threats when you're working with a pop star. Because you do Sorry, you do need to balance like letting them do their jobs, which are like, you know, involve other people, like performing, being very visible and public, you know, that is part of the job of being a pop star. But you need to balance that with security. And if he's never done that before, I feel like he probably doesn't know exactly where that balance lies.
Yeah,
that sounds right. I you know, Andrew, you brought up the poster. Mm. And there is a little bit of trivia on this poster, which is that is not Whitney Houston on the poster. The person that they basically were doing the photo shoot for the poster after Whitney had to go back to either touring or recording or what have you. So if you look at the poster, it's literally a woman who's covering her face and her head behind him. So you can't actually, not to mention the fact that Whitney never wears an outfit like this in the film either. But, you know, just goes to show that, you know, people don't really care about such things. Emily, do you know the tagline to The Bodyguard by any chance?
Looking at it last night. I cannot recite it offhand, but it's very long. Never let her down or something.
It's never let her out of your sight. Never let your guard down.
Oh, yeah.
Never fall in love.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fuck.
The three rules. Yes.
What if there was a bodyguard? That's to be
it. I'm coming around on this. The thing about this movie is that everything about it is good but the movie. And like I can't like the poster, that tagline, like, you know, just like the whole thing, but it really feels like, and I said this in my letterbox, it really feels like the soundtrack album came first and it was such a hit that they were like, we got to release some DLC for this. So they made a movie and we're like, we're going to release this movie as like an add-on to the soundtrack. And they kind of just, you know, afterthought.
Well, Emily, you got to look past the movie then. Like, you are admitting that you love this movie so much. It's just that you're so hung up on the movie part that you can't express how much you love it. Just exactly. Forget about the movie and express how great this movie is.
Yeah.
Minus the movie.
Coming around.
Yes.
I want to kind of unpack a little bit of what you were just saying, Emily, because it's worth noting. The soundtrack comes out on November 17th, 1992. The movie comes out on November 25th. So this was a soundtrack that was released way before the movie. My assumption is that the first single, obviously, was I Will Always Love You, and it was released on November 2nd. So
I'm joking. I know they made the soundtrack for this movie, but like...
Sure.
It does really feel like this movie exists to prop up the soundtrack in such a weird way. And like, obviously they fed into each other, but like the songs are so just elemental. And again, I didn't know most of them, but you hear them and you're like, oh, this is a song that has always been and will always be. And then you watch the movie and there's a guy with a gun shaped like a camera.
Oh, we're going to talk about the camera.
We have to, yes.
Okay. We will talk about that. But I just very quickly, there were six singles off of this soundtrack.
Wow.
Okay, so we're talking about like a year's worth of singles. Crazy. But yes, we'll talk about that in more depth on your episode. But it's worth noting that like this was... ultimately a Whitney Houston album release, and they had a single for Whitney, these were speaking to each other is basically what I'm getting at. They weren't so,
and that scene again, like I think that scene is very purposeful in that it establishes two things. Like it gives a chance for us, the audience, to recognize if we didn't know back in 92, she is the top of the echelon, right? This is Whitney Houston, who no matter where she goes, she causes such a hoopla that people are willing to go on stage and almost kill her because they love her so much, right? And then it also establishes that, you know, Kevin or Frank the farmer is like, man, I gotta let this crop grow. And the crop that she's trying to grow is...
What are we doing?
Is the love that he has for her, and also her understanding that without him specifically, she's fucked. So laying all of this craziness happen on stage, and then him kicking his way out of there when the other bodyguard, all he did was yell and lose the limo. Like, it really establishes Frank as the only hope that Rachel has in moving forward and winning the Academy Award for Best Actress in this amazing movie, that
Queen of the Night.
That's, I mean, you just, you know, right? Like, there's a reason.
Yeah.
For it.
I do agree with you that he's, as a bodyguard, trying to show how valuable he is. That being said, the scene that follows this is a scene where him and her other bodyguard just kind so of fight good. Like guys in a kitchen.
So good.
Like, my one note about that scene is just that men love to eat apples off the side of a knife.
Yes.
It's because we're dangerous.
That's actually why. Give me 5 minutes. I gotta go grab an apple and a knife. I'll be right back. No.
It is such a stupid scene for so many reasons. But then later, he beats up some random guy in the kitchen. And I'm just like, what the fuck is Kevin's problem with people in kitchens?
Well, if I had a bodyguard, I'd want him to beat up people in my kitchen.
Like, yes.
He's a Vietnam veteran, but he's only served in the kitchen. Like,
it's triggering.
I truly just don't understand it. As I was watching this, I don't know if you were doing this, Emily. I assume to some degree you do it subconsciously like I do. Where like I'm looking at the beats. Mm-hmm. I'm like looking at sort of the not set pieces, because there's not really that, but like there's
I stopped trying at some point, but please continue.
No, as we all should, because this movie doesn't warrant that type of thought. but it is just, I was watching it just being like, so he's got a bunch of cards on a board, and one of them says they fight in a kitchen, and he's got another one where he's like beats up guy in a kitchen. And you're just like, at no point did Lawrence Kasdan just go like, I don't know, man, I'm not sure that we're really getting into what makes Frank tick here.
I've now broken episodes of television, and like you'll look at the cards, mm-hmm. and you'll be like, this is gonna be so good. I imagine Kasdan looking at Frank bites a guy in a kitchen. He's like, fuck.
Fuck yeah. Yes.
Do it. Yes. I think we need to read this more as an action comedy than an action romance. Because if you look at it as a comedy, it's fucking, it's a really, like, rewatching this, I laughed so much because everything was so funny and it made it so enjoyable because you're like, really? After you saved Rachel, your next play is to beat up her former bodyguard, and really, former bodyguard, you want to try to take on the guy who kickboxed literally everyone in a concert hall when you can do a single thing, and then you double down and triple down, and then like was like, oh, you're not that big, that tough, you can't even throw a knife, and he bounces like the handle off of your freaking forehead. Like, it's hilarious. It's so funny.
Yeah,
this makes me wonder,
coming
and
around,
I feel like
I'm coming around.
I feel like
yes.
Emily,
top
I feel like
10
we've,
on Emily's
we've
letterbox.
Talked about this. We've talked about this. I'm not sure if we talked about it on the 92 podcast, but I think we talked about it on 99. But it's the idea of intent, right? Mm-hmm. Which is when you sit down and you sit down to write a thing, you sit down to direct a thing, and it becomes unintentionally enjoyable to people in a way that you never intended, right? The perfect example would be The Room, right? Like, he thought he was making a good movie, but it's obviously a laughably bad movie, and we all love it, and he kind of got on the bandwagon and turned it into what it is. This movie is clearly undeniably earnest and trying very hard to be a thing, which makes it that much more ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I was talking to friends today who defend this movie, and I was like, guys, it has a fucking camera gun. Like, it, you can't defend this movie. It's indefensible. But I also wonder whether or not, like, is that Emily, you were a critic for many years.
I was.
Is that a thing that you, when you were doing your critic
when
stuff,
I was being a critic,
do you think
person.
Do you think about intent, or do you think about your own enjoyment and what you got out of that movie?
It depends. Yes. Like, okay. I think my experience of the movie as a viewer, as a critic, even as a person who might someday make a movie, I think that ultimately my experience of watching the movie, obviously, if you make a movie, like, your experience of watching is you just see all the things in it that suck and you're going to be like, I wish this was better. But like, I think that things are made for the audience. And like, if the audience, the people who love The Bodyguard, you know, like, if they had that experience of watching it and loving it and having just like a great time and enjoying themselves, like, that is not an inaccurate response. I think the role of the critic is then to pull out the elements of stuff like, and I'm not like full death of the author, you know, I think that it is interesting to consider authorial intent, but like, yeah, I feel that if people love this movie because it's dumb, great, good, wonderful, perfect.
I think that's where I land on it as well. I think enjoyment is enjoyment, like full stop, right? Like if this art is giving you something, then that's the point of making art. And mm-hmm. I strenuously must say that I do not think this movie is art. That being said, I do think that it has artistic intent to some degree or another. And if it's allowing us to enjoy ourselves, then that's all that matters.
In the course of this conversation, The Bodyguard has crossed over the not art to art barrier for me.
Yeah,
this art.
Yeah.
I love when we can pinpoint the moment that happens for you, Emily. What were you going to say, Harper?
As someone, so other than sports, my other top genre is going to be romance. So I'm a big romance novel reader, and I'm also a big romance movie watcher. And so for me, one thing that really stood out to me in this was like those specific romance tropes that they really hit hard. Like the second that, well, one, when they first meet eyes, gorgeous, love it.
Right.
And it's like so established, like he's looking around the room, he's assessing threats, and then he sees her, you know, it's so good. But the really big one for me is, I know as soon as they sleep together, he's let his guard down. The bodyguard himself has let his own guard down. And it makes it impossible for him to do his job, though, because that's his whole identity, is he is the best bodyguard. He makes $3,000 a week. Everyone wants him, you know, and... you know, but he
can't. Are expensive. Yeah.
Even though, yeah, we've all talked though about how bad he is at his job, but the movie has established that he's the best, right?
And he throws two knives. They go nowhere, and he's like, "Oh wait, I gotta throw these other three knives. They all perfect." Continue.
Yeah. But you know, but the fact that he now has feelings for her, and this is something that bodyguard of celebrity romance is a subgenre, you know, and the moment when the bodyguard has become vulnerable is huge. And they did that in such a good way. And then, you know, the next morning when he says, oh, we can't do this anymore, you know, he has to, because he has to do his job. That's his core identity.
Yeah. But how much it hurts her.
I know.
And how, I really do think that. It's funny because as you're outlining these like kind of tropey romantic, you know, moments, I do feel like they kind of do a pretty good job of executing them. It's above average. I wouldn't say that they knocked it out of the park, but like that scene in particular, I think that Whitney's sort of pain and her how hurt she is by what he's saying is very real. Now, I think Costner, if I'm being completely honest, I think he's actually pretty dull in this movie. I don't actually really think he's a particularly charismatic. He can be really charismatic, and I think he thinks he's playing Steely when he's really just playing boring. So I get that, but it's just not playing particularly well.
I think he's actively bad in this movie, except now I think he's good.
Wow.
Yes. He's an artist. That's why you think he's good.
Yes. He's so bad it's good.
It's just really weird because the more we talk about this movie, the more I'm just like so confused by it more than anything. Like, was Mick Jackson in on it? Like, did he know he was making kind of a soapy kind of, I don't want to say campy, but like, did he think he was in on it, Emily?
I think he knew that this movie was a little bit silly. Like, he had to have. And like, I'm not like, I don't think he thought he was making a comedy in the slightest. I think he did have like a serious element of like, I'm going to make like a really good meaty movie. But like, yeah, you know, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of like ridiculous nonsense in this movie. And he had to have known. Mick, call us up.
I mean, if you have a machine gun camera at the kind of pinnacle of your movie,
camera gun.
You know you're making a comedy. Like you clearly know that this is not going to be taken too seriously.
I don't know. I don't know. Right. It could be like, know, hey, man, this is pretty sick. What if a camera was good?
Yeah, and hilarious. Sick at the best, hilarious at least, right? Like
it felt like a Bond movie.
Yes. I have to say, actually, of my problems with this movie, the camera gun was not on my list.
Because
you see him holding the camera and it pans over to him and you're like, oh, that's a man holding to a camera. And then you see the laser point and you're like, oh, it's a gun.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the moment for that shock. It got me. I don't know.
We did.
I think like this movie is like, I think one of the issues of this movie is like the discordancy with the tones and like Lawrence Kasdan doesn't seem to have a mastery of the tone. Like the director doesn't seem to have a mastery of the tone. And there's so many elements of this movie. There's the Whitney Houston stardom. There's a Kevin Costner dad movie. There's like, is this a romantic thing? Is it like kind of like they're playing with the romance tropes? It's like, I feel like if I'm just like an audience member in 1992, I'm like, would be like tossed around and stuff. Of like, I want to see a Whitney Houston movie, but there's all this other stuff that's like, there's the Silence of the Lambs sequence in the middle that's like kind of freaking me out, you know?
But I also wonder if that's kind of part of the secret sauce, which is that like, A, there's quote unquote something for everyone, but also once like something's happening that you're kind of bored by, then something else is happening that you're like, well, what the fuck is this, like how is this happening? But if you think about it for 5 seconds, which unfortunately we've been doing for much more than 5 seconds at this point, you do find yourself like the point when the movie kind of lost me, or when I stopped, I guess, caring about the plot, it's maybe the most but kind way to put it, they go to the woods to visit his dad because he wants to get Rachel and her sister Nikki and her son Fletcher off the grid. So they go to the woods, wherever the fuck the woods is, West Virginia, and we're kind of a little bit exposed to like what Frank's upbringing was, maybe sort of kind of. Mm-hmm. The dad talks about how when the mom died, that meant that Frank couldn't be there to protect Reagan, and that's why he got shot. I can't make this shit up. But that's, and it weighs on Frank. It's why he is the way he is, which is, I still don't really know what that means. We then, like, there's this scene where we realize that him and his dad have been playing a chess game for 3 years. And I'm just like, let me get this straight. You think this is scintillating to watch two old men, like, think about a chess move for an hour?
No.
Anyway, it's absurd.
Well, you find out that Fletcher is a chess genius.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bobby Fischer. We didn't know it, but he was. But the moment that it tips for me is the Nikki review.
Yes.
So let me just walk this out, because there's a part of me that I don't think this makes any fucking sense. Nikki decides she wants to hire a hitman to kill her sister out of jealousy.
Yeah.
Right? That part I get. But she does it because she's high or drunk and she goes to some club in Los Angeles where she finds a guy who's willing to help her hire a hitman.
As we've all done before.
Uh-huh. As we've all done. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but, based in our reality. You know?
But she hired said hitman after the stalker letters. So these are two separate incidences. We have a stalker who's writing letters, who might be dangerous, who, spoiler, they don't think is dangerous, and they just let go at the end of the movie. So he's just out and about doing whatever just things
don't
he's
do
doing.
It again.
And he's still there at the Oscars at the end.
He's at the Oscars.
He's a seat filler at the Oscars.
He's at the fucking, like, he's at the fucking ambulance. So that happens. So then we're led to believe that the people we should be really worried about is this organization, quote unquote, that Nikki hired to kill her sister, who then walks into the house and guns her down without even thinking about it, blows up a motorboat that I don't know how Kevin Costner knew was going to blow up, but
he's just that paranoid
did.
And he was right to be. I believe that's the implication. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is when the whole thing just goes off the fucking rails for me, because now I'm just like, I don't know who I'm supposed to be afraid of, and I don't know why I'm supposed to care.
Everyone. And yeah, you're supposed to care because it's a dangerous world out there and you could die at any time. The bodyguard.
How dare you defend this movie now, Emily?
In the middle of this podcast, is this episode coming out before or after our Memoirs of Invisible Man episode?
Before.
Okay. Well, in that episode, we talk a lot about the British film Threads, which is a terrifying, dark vision of nuclear holocaust.
Correct.
Also your favorite directed thing. By Mick Jackson.
Oh no.
This movie keeps going up.
Oh no.
Bodyguard. Bodyguard Hive. Assemble.
I guess the reason I'm trying to bring this up is because Nikki's plan, her reasoning, who she hired, it's all so muddy for me.
Yeah.
That I'm just like, I don't know which end is up, but you lost me.
First of all, like, they set up the stalker so effectively of like, they show the shots of him like cutting up the note, and like, that's really scary. And then also, like, in this movie, there's a lot of screenwriter math where it's just like every little thing is like set up, and then there's a punchline at the end of just like in the third act, like the I will always love you. Then they play it to the end, and then like the little cross thing they give her, like, and stuff like that. Yeah, there's like a lot of that. The orange juice like runner of just like, at the end, he like pours alcohol in his orange juice and like, that means he's changed. And so there's a lot of that. And then that reveals is like, I don't know, I was high. I don't know. Like, I really wasn't thinking about like, you.
Wait, I want to stop you very quickly.
Yeah.
He gives her because I just thought about this as you were talking. He gives her a cross that has a button in it that he says, you should press this if you ever feel like you're in danger.
Yeah.
That's your fucking job. You should know if I'm in danger. I shouldn't have to press a button. That's being a bodyguard.
I
don't understand.
I grew up in the church, and we all had crosses we could press if we were in danger, and Jesus would come down and save us. That's the prime advantage of, you only get one. Jesus is like, I'll give you one. But like, he's like Spider-Man.
Emily, remember yesterday when we discovered that Jesus was railroaded?
We did. We're
talking about Unforgiven.
We learned a lot about this podcast.
I love this podcast. But we are now at your favorite part, Emily. We're at the Oscars.
So fucking good.
I would watch a whole movie of Richard Schiff directing the Oscars.
Robert Wall is there, and he's like doing perfect Oscar jokes.
Yeah.
Hear the setups, but you hear him like, I wore an outfit like that in Miami, and you're like, fuck yeah, you nailed it.
Robert Smigel wrote for those Oscars, apparently. That's like a little trivia I found out. So.
Emily, do you think it's plausible that in 1992 Robert Wall would have hosted the Oscars?
He's not Robert Wall, he's playing somebody. He's playing some guy.
Oh,
it's like, this is an alternate universe where no one we know is famous. And everyone who's famous has weird names.
I was watching this thinking, like, are they doing, like, is this thinly veiled versions of other actors? And it's not. It's just a bunch of crazy names and movies that titles that don't even sound like movies.
Is my favorite thing is when there's fake movie titles and they just sound like words. And you're like, I recognize all of those words and I recognize them in like a sequence, but that doesn't sound like it. Hot or Cold is a title. What is that movie about? It's about the Irish potato famine. And one best picture.
You know
picture.
What? All these titles made me think of, and I've never seen this film, so I'm not shitting on this movie. But Crimes of the Heart is one of those titles for me that feels like it could be applied to like any movie.
Yeah, because then they had like Places in the Heart. You know, it's like
all in the heart. It's all. Debbie Reynolds has a great cameo.
Mm-hmm. It's going up and up and up.
Yeah. I was so shocked by that line.
It was weird too. It was like Debbie Reynolds shows up to shit talk Rachel. I mean, it was crazy. There's a moment when Frank yells at Tony, and Tony says like, "Where should I be?" He's like, "Those guys over there. Well, they don't need to be there. That guy with the camera. They don't need to be there." And I'm like, "Frank, this is a telecast. These people actually do need to be in these places. You can't just randomly be yelling at people that are making the Oscars happen."
Okay, see, this is my problem with right now. Okay, on the one hand, you all are saying, "Oh, Frank isn't a good bodyguard. He's not guarding Rachel." And now, when he's trying to do his fucking job and clear the stage, now all of a sudden you're like,
right.
"Oh." You need him.
Right.
No, you can't have your cake and eat it. Let Frank be Frank. Let the farmer cook.
Let it be Frank.
Let the farmer cook.
Yeah. Now, actually, when the Oscars won the Primetime Emmy at that year's ceremony in the Bodyguard universe, Frank Farmer also won for directing. It was him and Richard Schiff.
Also, so, Richard Schiff isn't on the West Wing. He's just like an Oscar director in that universe too.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this Earth 2 version that we've created where this is the Oscars. But so at this point, it's very strange because there's like a stutter step, which is that Rachel is a presenter as well as a nominee, which, by the way, doesn't happen particularly often because the nominees generally are sitting in their fucking seats.
I mean, they will do it, but it'll be like Meryl Streep comes out to present like editing at the start, and then she's in her seat.
She has lots of time.
But also, this is a category that the film she's nominated for is also nominated for, and she didn't write the song, so technically this is permissible by the Academy's rules. I'm glad Lawrence Kasdan did his research, but like, it's still very strange because you have to assume that song is going to win because you hear the titles of the other songs. They don't sound like songs that exist at all. They sound like songs somebody made up for a movie. But like,
right, like if Lady Gaga was presenting the best song for A Star Is Born, you'd just be like, this doesn't make any sense because she's probably involved. It's very strange. But she presents Rachel goes on stage, and we have what I think the director thinks is a tension-filled sequence of her worried that there's all these people in the audience that are going to try to kill her. And she panics and just flees the stage. And then she gets angry at Frank because he got in her head and he's freaked her out. I don't think we needed it, but whatever. Question to go sort of to everybody here. If you were trying to assassinate somebody.
Mm-hmm. I've done it.
No follow-ups.
The character of this movie.
Why pick the fucking Oscars?
Why?
Like, God. This is a stupid venue to try to kill somebody. Well,
why did Will Smith smack Chris Rock at the Oscars? You know,
it's fair.
Everyone's
fair.
Watching.
It's a good question.
I mean, it's everyone if you have watching. A camera gun, though, like that's like the perfect in to like,
yes.
You just say you're with Entertainment Tonight and have a camera gun.
Until John Tesh should have been the assassin. He's in this movie.
He is in this movie.
Wow.
So we're now at the camera gun. Yes. And I want to just sort of preface this by saying that earlier in the film, we have a moment when Frank crosses paths with an ex bodyguard named Portman.
Classic.
And as is the case with movies like this, whenever another character, an extraneous character, is introduced, they're probably going to have a point. They're probably going to come back. Mm-hmm. Frank and Rachel start flirting. Not Frank, sorry. Portman and Rachel start flirting, and they have this almost kind of rapey scene together, which is really gross and awful. And we think that's the last we've seen of him, but it's not, because Frank is in fact the assassin that is going to try to
Frank
kill
is not the assassin.
Portman.
I, you know what? I watched that scene and I was like, I bet he's the assassin. And I was right. This movie.
You watched that scene?
The logic of this movie is impeccable and it all holds up.
Steve? Emily?
Airtight.
Yeah. So good. This is so great. I'm so proud right now. I'm so happy.
So basically what happens is Frank realizes that Portman is there. And he realizes that his camera is a gun.
I mean, of course.
And now when I say this to our listeners who maybe have not seen The Bodyguard, I'm going to just describe what is a video camera, which looks like a normal video camera.
Got it.
And a gun just stuck to the side of it with a fucking laser sight. So it's not as though it's hidden inside the camera and he's able to like pull it out and use it. It is directly attached to the camera, which would be very hard to use. And not an effective tool. Because if you're looking through the lens of the camera, it's not actually where the gun is. So, like, this doesn't actually make any fucking sense.
Well, he also has a laser.
There's a laser.
He does have the laser, but the laser...
He also has to telecast. Yes, you're right. He has a laser, too. So he has another job to do also.
Yeah. No. He has a laser.
Remember, bodyguards they only make $3,000 a week if they're really good. This Portman character is making maybe $500 a month. He's got to
go
hustle.
To my day job of filming the Oscars.
Yeah. He's UK. The reason, like Portman, you have to hire him on a hitman app, and that's a problem for him because the internet has not been invented yet.
Yes,
so he's
yes.
just sitting there staring at a brick and being like, I hope this becomes a phone and I could get some work.
It is ridiculous. You then have a slow motion sequence where Frank pieces it all together. He dives in front of Whitney. So he takes the bullet that I guess he would have done for Reagan. He falls to the ground. His blood splatters over the card that says her name for winning Best Actress, which is just a beautiful thing. Her PR person picks up said card and tries to wipe the blood off of it before putting it into his pocket. This so is just dumb. Poetry.
It sounds so good when you say it out loud sequence.
Here's the thing I'm running into. I will never confirm if my growing appreciation for this movie is a bit or not. But when you describe the events of it out loud, it does sound kind of good.
Yes. An amazing comedy. It's so good.
Yeah. I think Cy, the publicist, has my favorite line in the entire movie. Yeah. He says, this is early at the beginning when they're first meeting Frank. He says, Tuesday morning brunch? Where do you get this guy, Bill? Suggests going to
that's
brunch.
That's just legit funny. That's hilarious.
It's so good.
That's so good. Also, isn't it wild how Rachel was so emotional, distraught over the thought of Frank being shot and knowing that he's going to survive, but still so emotional. But when her sister died, she was like, sometimes it's just time to go.
Shit happens.
Just shit happens.
We sang Jesus Loves Me together at one point.
What? What was that all about?
I have never heard that version of Jesus Loves. It's beautiful, but I'm also where are they getting this? It's interesting. That was interesting.
Also, in that moment, you actually realize, her sister fucking hates her guts because here she is just singing this song, slow moment, and then Whitney comes over the top like an angel god, being like, oh, wait, hold on, Jesus loves me because of my voice, and I'm going to prove it, you skank whore. And then
it is amazing.
She sings it. You're like, oh, that poor sister just wanted to have a spiritual moment. Now she's got to hire another hitman who can masturbate on the bed. And
it's a great moment because basically the sister Nikki is just sitting on the porch, just singing this lovely. And by the way, Nikki does have a nice voice.
Yeah. She does. Yeah.
But then Whitney comes like a fucking sledgehammer, just absolutely eviscerates her. Comes from out of frame, and you're just like, yeah, I get it. I probably want to kill her too. I mean, this is terrible. You can't actually win.
Yeah.
Oh my.
It's probably what Solange feels like with Beyonce.
Oh my sister.
Wow.
Just saying.
Wow.
I like
Solange,
that song.
Good singer. Yeah. She's a Beyonce.
I don't know. What?
Is that a hot take?
That is a hot take. I don't know. Solange's last album is pretty good. I'm not going to lie. It did slap. Anyway.
I'm sorry.
All my sisters hate how good of a singer I am. So.
I have a question about the end of the movie. Well, actually, from the point that Nikki dies to the end, we think that no one told Whitney Houston, Rachel, that her sister was behind the assassination attempt?
No, absolutely not.
No one tells Rachel anything. No one told Rachel that someone jerked off in her bed.
No one told Rachel that her sister died, actually. She had no idea. That's why she didn't react. She's like, oh, we're at this funeral party? Okay, cool. We're pretend like she's dead? All right. Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, to your point, though, Harper, it is... I mean, listen, I have lots of notes on this movie, obviously. Oh. But I think one of the sort of protecting her from herself, cloistering this woman that has all these men as her puppet master is also kind of gross and terrible. It would have been nice if Nikki wasn't the villain. You know what I mean? It would have been nice if there was a woman in this film that could be her confidant, that could be someone that could actually be helpful to her. I mean, again, as Emily has attested on many times, a lot of men in 1992, not a lot of women.
I don't know. I think that there is a part of me that has, there is a fantasy, I think, especially in the gendered power dynamics we exist within, that is sort of I am a powerful, extremely wonderful woman who is the greatest being on the planet and I'm famous and blah, blah, blah. But I don't have time to keep up with all my shit. So I'm going to hire a bunch of dudes and they're going to surround me. They're all going to be subservient to me, but they're all going to like make sure that my life is perfect. And they're going to take care of me and they're going to provide. There is something in that that's kind of like appealing. And I think that's why a lot of movies like this and Star Is Born work, because there is sort of like this idea of it flips the traditional power dynamics of the heterosexual romance on their ear, because the woman is more powerful technically. She employs the guy, but like, you know, he's the one who's stepping in to protect her. And like, there is something kind of hot about that.
Do you think that's what Queen of the Night is about?
No, I think that's a musical version of Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
Okay.
I also think the movie's 3 minutes long. They don't, there's no other parts of that movie. to that point, Emily's point though, there's also like Lawrence Kasdan and like Kevin Costner are kind of the auteurs of this movie. Like, and I think it like there is that element of like, yes, it is sexy that like she's employing all these women. She is technically more powerful than Kevin Costner and all these guys. But it's also like the message of the movie is like, you have to listen to Kevin Costner. He's the one who knows everything. Anytime you want to step out and like, you know, be public, you're wrong because the world is so dangerous and stuff and you can't handle it. You're like a little baby bird. It's like there's like this there's this really like, yeah, kind of gross element to it too.
I mean I agree with everything you guys are saying. Like I don't think that this movie is necessarily like malicious in its intent, but I do think that there is sort of some misogyny in there, and there was a lot of misogyny in the early 90s.
Misogyny, obviously, in a movie from the early 90s? What?
I know it's crazy, it's a hot take, but I felt kind of, it felt like it wasn't fair to Rachel's character is ultimately what it comes down to. Like this not informing her of like significant things that are going on in her life because you feel like you just want her to keep making, like it felt very kind of Britney to me, of this like, just keep dancing, just keep singing, just keep making us money and we'll just make sure that everything is okay. And that felt kind of icky to me. But I mean,
if I was Taylor Swift's bodyguard, which I am and should be,
which you are,
I would tell her nothing. I would say everything's fine. I've taken care of it. You are perfectly safe, my lady.
Yeah. I hope that we can just get a clip of that video of the look on your face when you said, I will tell her nothing. It is incredible. And I'm going to demand it from our producers.
The problem with my desire to be friends with Taylor Swift is there's so much evidence of me being completely fucking off the wall about Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Can I tell
Taylor should stay far away from me?
Can I tell a story about a therapist I once had? I had a therapist in the year 2020 when we were all having a great time. And I would do video therapy with her every week. And one time I was like, I was really into Taylor Swift at that time. Like, I love Taylor Swift still, but then I was like really fucking into her. And I was like, I just want to be Taylor Swift's friend. And I feel like this is a problem in my brain. And I feel like I need to talk about this and need to think about this because it's not going to happen. And if it did, she would never be able to be a friend to the degree that I want her to be. I am responding to her public persona. I was like saying all this out loud to hear it. My therapist said, well, you never know. I know a guy who felt that way about Grace Slick when we were in college. And then 20 years later, he moved to LA and who should he meet but Grace Slick? And now they're best friends and like they hang out together all the time. And I was like, this is the exact wrong thing to tell me in this moment.
That is bad therapy.
She was a great therapist, but that was like the moment when I was like, well, I'm going to pull this off. It's going to happen for me.
That is, I mean, listen, I'm all for therapists, you know,
being encouraging,
saying being encouraging and being positive, but also you got
to
be pretty great.
I mean, in 2020, everyone wanted to give me something to live for. So. Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair.
But now I do have a friend who has a friend who went to a birthday party for a child that Taylor Swift was at. I'm not going to name any names here, but like she got a photo of Taylor Swift with my friend.
I mean, wow. And not just to, like, not to
friend of a friend.
Emily,
yeah.
But we did
went
do
to a birthday a party podcast. Of a child.
Yeah.
We did a podcast with one of Taylor's best friends.
Yeah. You know,
we had Esty Heim on here.
Harper's right there. You know. Like Harper and Taylor go way back.
So true. All the way back to August 4th at SoFi Stadium.
Oh, you were there too? I think that was the day I was there.
Oh, nice.
I'm not sure. But
and that date in 2020 when Soup Plantation closed.
that you guys crossed paths there too. Yeah.
Of course.
Well, and weirdly, Taylor is co-owner of Soup Plantation.
Oh no!
I think
we
should start that rumor.
Oh, it's been started. Yeah, there it is.
His face is like, maybe we don't.
I just
don't
like
do anything to jeopardize the friendship.
I'm thinking a lot about how everybody in 1995 knew that Paul from the Wonder Years had grown up to be Marilyn Manson. And like now things go viral in such a weird way. And it's just like, what if that went viral? What if that's the what if that's the cultural impact of this podcast?
Oh,
is a bunch of people thinking Taylor Swift is the co-owner of Soup Plantation, a Southern California soup and salad buffet company that most people have never heard of.
By the way, listen, if that's how we get to be a big podcast, Emily, that's the way it happens. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. So at the end of our podcast, guys, we rank our films from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 obviously being the highest, 50% or 50 being the sort of number of which you would recommend this film to other people. Coming into this podcast, I had this film at a 40. I was like, that feels about right. It pains me to say this.
Yes.
But this conversation has made me go up. I'm going to say I am now at a 57.
Ooh.
Oh.
I would recommend this people with the caveat to not think about it and just go along with this dumb ride and just enjoy it. The music rips. It's got some good chemistry. It's got a camera gun. I mean, it's really kind of got everything you want. So that's where I'm at. I'm at a 57. Where are you, Emily?
Do me last.
Okay. Harper, where are you?
Yeah. I want to mention that my third favorite genre after sports and romance is action. One of my favorite movies being Shoot 'Em Up, where he shoots a carrot from between his fingers and into someone's eye. Also Bullets. It's Bullets using a fireplace from his broken fingers, and then also separately there's a carrot. So to me, the camera gun.
Have you seen the film Sleepwalkers by any chance?
I have not.
You've seen? Okay, it's a 1992 movie that we did an episode on. Someone gets stabbed with a corn cob.
Nice.
I'm just saying, if you're looking for vegetables penetrating people, that's
who is it?
Love it. I'm adding it to the list right now.
That's the only movie out there that you can recommend.
But yeah, so it really hit a lot of my specific genre interests. This movie, but I will say that I did struggle with the pacing. And a lot of the writing, and I will give it a 55 though. I was thinking 55, and then you said 57, so I'm right there with you. I think that's how I feel too.
Stanley, where are you at?
Listen, when Superman faces Kryptonite, he becomes weaker. He loses his power to defend the world. And when Frank the Farmer faces the love of his life, he too loses his power to defend the one thing he needs to defend, which is Rachel. And for that reason, I think I should give this movie a 92. Here's why. Because, you know, sometimes we take love too seriously. And love can be a comedy, love can be a joke. But above all, love can conquer all, including the death of your sister, someone jerking off in your bed, stealing a country song, and most importantly, stopping a flight from leaving to whatever gig you needed to go to after all those fucking crazy things happened. And yet love was still present. So I recommend this movie to everyone that wants to find love.
Jesus Christ.
And hasn't found love yet. And they wanted time travel to a time where love was allowed between all people.
Wow.
1992. Kevin Costner, Whitney Houston, R.I.P. Witt. Yeah. I will always love this movie. 92.
Andrew?
Wow, I'm gonna have to follow that.
How do you follow that up?
Yeah,
man.
I didn't like this movie watching it. I like it more talking about it, but I don't like that we're doing more work than the movie does of like organizing all these thoughts and, you know, like I do
welcome
like
to podcasts like it's 1990s.
I do like that it's like an underlining of like what makes Whitney Houston so great and the tragedy of her life, like. That even at the peak of her career, she wasn't quite free. And now we got Taylor and Beyonce, like Taylor re-recording all her songs, get her masters back. Like if Beyonce had the rights to make this movie, she would be like, okay, scrap this. Let's get Barry Jenkins. Let's get Steve McQueen. Let's get Ez Devlin to do the stage design. Sure. She has her own ecosystem to be creative and have autonomy, which like she does, like Whitney doesn't have at this point in her career. She kind of gets it with Cinderella, but not where Beyonce is now.
Sure.
So that's really awesome. Yeah, I'm going to give it, I'm going to give it like 58, a little higher than Philip. So okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Emily.
So I came, where you at? I came into this podcast at 25. I did not like this movie at all. I had not a good time watching it. I was very annoyed at the fact that people like this movie. I thought that those who enjoy this film are weak of constitution and mind. And I was like, you know what? Anybody can enjoy anything except The Bodyguard. That was kind of my attitude coming in. This conversation has awakened me to some of the more positive aspects of the film. Certainly Whitney's performance is lovely. The songs are great. There's some nice like moments in it. There is some fun comedy. And I think Harper's point about nailing those like specific romantic moments is so well taken. And so I have taken all of that into consideration. My score is going to go up a little bit. It's going to go up to an 88. And
let's go, Emily.
This is one of the best movies ever. This is one of the best movies ever made, and I think everyone should watch it.
Yeah. Can I just say that this has been like literally the arc of the Grinch?
Her heart's grown 10 times. Please,
your heart's grown a chart exponentially.
I know that we have a fucking like schedule to keep to, but like just like release this on Christmas Day so people can like feel the joy of me.
It's coming close. Yeah. I'm curious if you guys have seen the film that we're covering next week. We have Liz Hanna coming on, screenwriter and showrunner, to talk about Sneakers, the Robert Redford film.
I haven't seen it. It's so high on my list. I feel like I've been thinking about watching it all year and I haven't gotten to it.
I don't know if you are a subscriber to the Criterion channel, but it is on Criterion right now. If you are, to our listeners, this is the perfect time to watch it. Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, Mary McDonnell. It's a great movie. A lot of fun. We discuss when Robert Redford was his most fuckable, which seems like pretty much his entire life, it seems, for the most part. Emily, I couldn't really get a sense of your feelings about Robert Redford. Like, do you mean, I know we talked about him on the podcast a little bit, but we talked more about the movie in general. I'm just sort of curious, pro, anti?
I think
he's hot.
I like Bob, you know, I think he's
Bob Redford.
He's done some great stuff. And he's done some stuff I don't like as much.
Yeah.
So that's, he did not make The Bodyguard, which takes him down a notch in my mind.
But you know what he did do, Emily?
What?
A River Runs Through It.
That river ran through it. I missed that episode, and I can't say that I'm sad.
You shouldn't be.
But our
listeners should look forward to a lot of talk about fly fishing sometime in the near future. Guys, please plug away the various ways that people can see you and hear you and, I don't know, follow you.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Like, first of all, thank you so much for having us. This is such a delight. Like, Emily, like I've said this in the past, like I've read those AV Club reviews like when I was in high school and study lab or whatever,
just to make you feel real old.
And it was like you were like my version of like Roger Ebert, where like I was like really inspired me to like think more critically, and like those essays about like it really changed my mind of how I approached like media. And Phil, I saw some of those Sleepy Hollow promos on Glee. Like when I was watching Glee, you know. Another like
fantastic.
Another thing is like we talked about this on the Rocky Horror episode of our show, where we talk about your review of the Rocky Horror Glee Show episode.
One of the best. It's like one of your best reviews,
Emily. Okay.
Go ahead.
It's 100% the screen cap that Miles McNaught made for it, but go ahead.
Yeah. So exactly, it's that screen cap, and I looked up the looked it up on my computer, and the screen cap was gone. I remember that screen cap so vividly from, you know, when I was a kid, and so like I made that screen cap like the little icons on like the group chats for our podcast. Uh-huh. So like that's your legacy. So that's pretty cool.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, like our show, I've been meaning to listen to that. We review albums every week. We review albums we've been meaning to listen to, use as a conduit to learn about each other and our guests. Emily was on to talk Nirvana in Utero.
Oh,
fantastic
really?
Episode. What are some other episodes you guys like, Harper and Stanley? What do you guys recommend?
Oh, well, the Olivia Rodrigo episode's going to come out. I had a really fun time talking about Guts.
Good album.
Yeah.
Good album. I can't listen to it. It gives me PTSD and I don't know why.
Oh, wow.
Genuinely.
That's interesting.
For real. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just talk to your therapist.
I mean, we have been. I'm going to be friends with Olivia before you know it.
Before we go, yeah. Emily, queerphobia scale. Where does this fall on that?
This film is a negative two on the queerphobia scale because this film believes in love. Actually, I don't know. My general standard for all 1992 movies is that everything is a baseline of a two because everybody in the movie you can assume is making jokes about gay people when the camera's not on them. And this movie probably has that. Surprisingly, there's not a lot of like anti-gay humor, like which you might have thought would be there. So I'm going to keep it at a two or a negative two because of love.
Because love. Love wins all. People can listen to your podcast wherever they listen to podcasts, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. Are you guys on social media in any capacity?
Yeah, IBMTLTT on Instagram and TikTok. You can follow Harper at Harping About on Instagram. Stenley at Snapasten on Instagram. Myself at Andrew Ambrose Lee on Instagram. And Michael at, he's not here, he's the other host. He was here, but he was just like really quiet. He was very
super the whole time.
Yeah, I'm Michael, hi.
Is also, that Terrence or Philip?
I think I might be changing my Instagram to The Bodyguard. So capital T. I haven't decided yet, so it might happen. So follow there, maybe.
Follow there too, possibly.
Yeah. So those are our socials. Yeah.
Well, honestly, this was a blast. We hope that you guys will come back in the future.
Yes.
Can't wait to be on your podcast imminently.
Talk Kenny G as well. Talk Kenny G's contributions to the Bodyguard
is
soundtrack.
Kenny G's on the
Bodyguard soundtrack.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm very excited to listen to that. We hope that you guys will come back. And I guess that's that, right? Is there anything else, Emily, that we need to talk about?
No, I mean, I could talk for hours. I was going to go see The Holdovers and that passed. And I was like, well, maybe I'll go see The Marvels and that passed. And now I'm like, I'm going to go see Thanksgiving. No, I'm just going to stay at home.
Well, I hear Thanksgiving's fun. I liked The Marvels.
Yeah, me too.
And I like The Holdovers. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. Right. Yeah, there you go. All right, guys. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Harry.
Bye.
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 Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com